This is Emma Schrader. Is David Schiffer in?
Sure, hold on a minute, please.
Thanks.
Hello.
Hi, David. This is Emma.
Oh, hey, Emma. How are you?
I'm doing well. Is this an okay time to call and talk to
you? Yeah, this is fine.
Okay, great. It was a little earlier, but I got things done that I needed to this morning, so...
Okay, good.
Before I ask you questions, I have to ask you if you agree to... I need your oral consent to participate in my research.
Okay.
I'll let you know that I'm doing this for my master's in geography, and I'd like to record this interview one. Is that okay?
Sure, that's fine.
And then... If I quote you or use things that you say, can I use your real name or should I use a pseudonym?
No, you can use my real name.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
And 1 second.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. So, great. Why don't tell me a little bit about how you're doing your... Is this for your thesis?
Yes, this is for my master's thesis.
Yeah, right. How are you going about... I mean, how are you doing your thesis? Is it interview-based, or...?
It is ending up being primarily interview-based. I'm also doing... I have a plot in the garden, and so I'm going to garden meetings and talking to a lot of gardeners and being out there a bit.
Uh-huh.
I'm quite a bit, actually. It's where I like to spend a lot of my time. But I also am doing some... not really field studies, but trying to get a handle on the ecology and how the different parts of the garden as well as the surrounding areas interact ecologically a little bit. And then I'm also doing some archival work, and I haven't gotten to do as much of that this summer as I meant to, but going through some things at the Eagle Heights Community Center in the Steenbach archives. And I'm hoping to get to the facilities planning and management, the landscape architect, architecture.
Yeah, is that Gary Brown still?
Gary Brown, and I believe that Rhonda James is the main person, or is the contact that I've been given for.
Never met her, but...
Yeah. It sounds like Gary Brown is the head and she's under him.
Oh, good.
But I haven't made it over there yet, so...
Gary, have you met Gary?
I have not. No, I think I saw him at one of the garden committee meetings, but no, I haven't met him personally yet.
Well, say hi if you do meet him.
Okay.
He was a great ally.
Mm.
You know, during the time that I was there,
mm-hmm.
He was a really, really forward-looking guy in terms of the whole campus plan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to talk. You know, it's a beautiful day here in Vermont. I've got you out in my garden.
Nice.
I'm going to pick jalapeno peppers and onions while we talk. How about that?
That sounds great. I wish I could be outside picking things right now. I was just out there, actually. Got some good cherry tomatoes. And, yeah, the tomatoes are finally starting to come in.
So where is your plot?
My plot is I have 212.
212. Okay, so you're down low.
Down low, yeah. So... Okay. Yeah.
And is the garden still, are you guys still getting all the wonderful piles of, say, lake weed and leaf mulch? And leaf mulch wouldn't be until a little later, but do the groundspeople help you out with that kind of stuff?
Yeah, they do. Actually, we just got a pile of lake weeds. They, people that I have been talking to were very excited about them because they haven't come in a few years, I guess. But
oh, yeah, right.
But they're like, we have lake weeds. Everybody go get lake weeds.
Oh, yeah. That is the best stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Boy.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that was always the fun part about being on the committee was making sure that all the good stuff kept coming in. How about now, do you do, I don't know, are you on the garden committee?
I'm not. This is actually my first summer in Madison, and so I'm just getting getting into it.
Yeah, beware! I tell you, that garden it's such a beautiful place. It can become such a time trap.
I already know.
It was my definitely my preferred route of procrastination.
Yeah.
Being out there.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about your experiences, how you started in the garden. What got you onto the garden committee, and then
yeah.
Because you have a big story to tell about the gardens, and I don't know where you want to start.
I do. I don't want to. Let's see. So 1995 was my acceptance into Eagle Heights. Not Take It Back. 1997, I believe.
Okay.
My first year there. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, we just wandered out there and saw, you know, because it's such a beautiful campus, and took a walk out, saw the gardens, and, you know, I had never had a garden, and I didn't have a whole lot of interest, except that I had been spending, you know, tons of money buying organic food, you know, as we were starting to get organic food stores. This was in the 90s, right, when Whole Foods was just barely known. So I knew, what the rationale was. And I don't know, it was just such a captivating piece of land that, it was our first garden, my wife and I together. And, and she was having a new baby. So as she was pregnant with our first baby, and we were, I guess we were kind of in nesting mode, right? We got a garden, and we just, I would say our happiest, you know, our happiest moments together as we started a brand new family were spent, you know, outdoors in that, just that beautiful piece of land, gardening and meeting people, really. It was as much about the other people who we met there as it was about, you know, watching our own food grow. And it's just always exciting. And, you know, the first time that you grow something yourself, it's exciting, as stupid as that sounds, to, you know, especially to young people. Yeah. Like, God, this sounds so boring.
No, it doesn't.
It's not, especially, you know, after you've been paying your bills for a few years and you know what the cost of food is, it's exciting to see something grow that you're actually going to eat and enjoy eating. My wife is Spanish. By the way, and so there's something in that I think that matters. I'm not sure, except that, you know, the kind of food we eat is largely vegetable-based, you know, Mediterranean-type stuff. So, you know, just being able to grow stuff that you know, we weren't able to find good-tasting and fresh on our own for less than a small fortune.
Yeah, I know.
You know, that was what got us out there. Okay, so once we got out there, we actually, you know, we started meeting the other, once you get out there, some hardcore gardener always approaches you, right?
Yep.
So I don't know who the hardcore gardener who first approached you was, but of course, there was one character who, I hope you'll find him in your research. His name is Bob Gifford.
Bob Gifford, and I haven't heard that
I don't
name
know if
yet.
Jan mentioned Bob Gifford.
No, not yet, I don't believe.
And Bob Gifford was, in my opinion, I mean, he was the first awesomely inspired gardener who I met. And Bob, unfortunately, was so inspired that he ended up getting a divorce, largely because he was so addicted to his garden. You know, so it can be a dangerous thing out there, because, like I say, that piece of land really can captivate you in, you know, ways that are great, and sometimes ways that are just even sometimes too powerful. And Bob was one of those guys. He ended up, you know, with 6 garden plots, and, you know, his goal was to grow and store all his own food, and you know, he was always just so excited to be out there and talk about it. So he was the garden chair for many years. And he was a very smart, capable guy. He got his degree in meteorology, and he moved off to Texas with that.
Okay,
so if you find him, maybe you'll find him out west.
Okay.
You know, so people start giving you tidbits of information when you don't know how to grow anything, and people start giving you plants and giving you seeds, and, you know, the whole community garden part of it just is what hooks people so fast, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know that I would have been, you know, so. I'm a gung-ho hardcore gardener now, and I'm mm-hmm. talking to you from a 3,000 square foot garden
oh.
where I grow most of our food.
Uh-huh.
And that yeah. all started at Eagle Heights.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just you know, because there's this mix of people out there. There's the people who just want to grow a tomato, and then inevitably you get people out there who are like, no, wait, you know, let me turn you on to something, you know, a little more.
Yeah.
And so there was another guy I met
okay.
who
name?
Did that. His name is Scott Barnwell.
Mm.
Scott Barnwell got his degree in through IES.
Mm.
You still call it IES, Institute for Environmental Studies?
Yep.
Land Resources is his
oh, okay.
degree. And I believe he's in North Carolina now, in the Asheville area.
Mm,
or is that South Carolina? I forget.
It is North Carolina, yeah.
But Scott Barnwell was one guy who we met out there early on. And, you know, he said, oh, yeah, you know, these little plots of land, you don't need a whole lot more than that to actually grow all your own food. I was like, ah, get out of here. You know, what are you talking about? And he's like, no, really. He's like, I just read this book by John Jevons. John Jevons is a guy who, I don't know if you know who he is.
No, I don't know, actually.
John Jevons is an old man now who lives out in California who runs his own organization called Ecology Action.
Okay.
And if you look up John Jevons on the internet, you'll quickly find his organization. And, you know, he's written books and has dedicated his life to how to grow as much food as possible on the smallest amount of land.
Mm.
And so John Jevons, I think, was a poli-sci major out in California
mm-hmm.
when, you know, when gardening kind of distracted him in a major way.
Yep.
And so he turned his life to that question of, you know, how can all these people who have, like, hardly any land, how can they survive on it? And
mm-hmm.
so he's spent some, 40 years now or more through his organization, you know, publishing and researching.
Mm-hmm.
He runs this, what he calls a mini farm out in Willits, California.
Mm-hmm.
And so he runs this farm out there where it's a research farm. It's all hand scale. They don't use machines.
Uh-huh.
They do things. It's sustainable gardening as much as that can be claimed.
Uh-huh.
Meaning they don't bring in any inputs.
Okay.
They
okay.
grow everything they need for compost. And,
mm.
You know, ecology in its finest sense.
Yes.
You know, no nutrients into the system kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so, so being out in the gardens, I, you know, had a big perspective pretty quickly about what gardening could mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, beyond just myself.
Yeah.
And since I was a student in environmental studies, that was, you know, it
mm-hmm.
had a strong message that was relevant to me.
Yeah.
You know, because I was doing development studies as well.
Okay, yep.
And so the gardening had that meaning to me. It was
mm-hmm.
like, oh, wow, yeah, I can grow my own food and I can also be plugged into this whole new, what I thought of as conservation, and
mm-hmm.
I still do,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is how to conserve land by growing really intensively and sustainably.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what I was, at least thought I was doing out in the gardens, and yeah, I still think people do that there.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I'd say so.
And do you want to butt in at any time? Cause
I will, but this is fascinating, so keep going.
Let me go back to Bob Gifford.
Okay.
Bob Gifford was, you know, like I said, he was the chairperson back in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a very, the garden committee was largely made up of community members who were
mm-hmm.
no longer, there were some PhD students. Eric Olmanson is another name who would have wonderful things to say in lots of history. Okay. Bob Gifford, Eric Olmanson, Olmanson.
O-N, okay.
And Eric was a PhD student, geography, yep.
Oh, okay.
In your department. Don't know what he did his thesis on, but he was as involved as Bob Gifford, and, you know, I was just fascinated by how these people would you know, come together and be so enthusiastic about this plot of land that that nobody really paid attention to, except for the garden committee. You know, as you know, most of the gardeners out there, they take it very much for granted.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, they just figure, hey, this is something the university provides. You know, the university as a team of administrators could care less about that place, or at least that was that was the attitude, you know, that led us into the times that we had when I was there. They didn't care. Most of them didn't even know about it. But Eric Olmanson he was on the garden committee, and he took care of the grounds. That was his main role. He was the fixer, the mower, and all that. You know, these guys are bound with energy. Bound with energy. Just for getting things like, you know, leaf mulch and lakeweed and just that.
Yeah.
You know, you could just tell that, you know, every bit of what they did was out of pure joy for the... So that's what I walked into, you know, a group of people who were so happy to be gardening out in this, you know, on that piece of land. And I've always maintained that the land is what draws that kind of energy as well, right? For a lot of us coming from urban areas, to be able to kind of claim a piece of land, you know, for as long as we're going to live, you know, in Eagle Heights or wherever you are, and kind of call it your own and have it be out in this natural area or semi-natural area, you know, that's pretty powerful. You know, the land has a way of really drawing you in and kind of taking a hold of you. That, at least for me, I had never experienced that before, and man, it took hold of me really hard.
So how did you stumble upon going to the committee meetings? You met these people and they said, come to the committee meetings, or you...
Yeah, it was more like, please come and, you know, be a part of the garden committee.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, it's always hard to get dedicated people there. And, yeah, I did, and I forget, I think I was on that committee for... a couple years, and boy, I kind of took over Eric's job as being a grounds guy for a while. I was terrible. I was terribly neglectful, and I didn't even know how to change a lawnmower blade. I wasn't the best grounds guy for the garden, but I got involved that way, and one more name I'll throw at you.
Yeah.
Probably still in Madison. Her name is Christine Stesser. Steusser.
Okay.
And if she ever attended UW, I don't know. She was always, you know, she was always a gardener from the wider community when I was there. She was a powerful sort of not a presence, because she was, you know, she was rather soft spoken, but she really made sure that things like the institutions, and there weren't many, but that the institutions stayed in place, and the institutions were things like the seed swap. Do you guys still do the seed swap? Have you heard?
Yes, we do. We do indeed.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. So you get the donations from the different companies, that was Chris Stesser who started that. She started writing to all these companies, and so she was the first one to get, you know, I mean, boxes of seed donations where we were like, oh, wait a minute, now do something with this.
Yeah.
She can,
do you know when that started, the first seed swap was?
I'll say it was the first seed swap. It was my first seed swap, and I just remember Chris being new at doing the writing part of that. So I'm going to guess it was the first, and I'm going to say that was in 1997.
Okay, yeah.
And what a wonder! I mean, and that is such an amazing thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that in itself is what carried. You know, if you don't have to pay for it,
yep.
I'm planting, right?
Yep.
That's what introduced me to a ton of different foods that I had never even heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Just the fact that they had a seed swap, and you know, shoot, I got the seeds, I may as well plant it.
Yep.
That was it. It was a grand experiment, you know, for the first years as I got to learn what plants were what just by planting them out from seed from that seed swap.
Yeah.
And then we got into later years when I was chair and I knew more people, we kind of ran with that idea and we said we turned the seed swap into one where we would. Ask the Chinese and Korean gardeners to really participate, and that was a real outreach effort because they weren't used to participating.
Yeah,
and I think their attitude was, you know, the other people run it. You know, they always felt like outsiders. And then through the seed swap, we said no, you know, we started doing garden tours first, and you know, where we would ask these gardeners to show people what it was they were growing, because, as you know, they have some pretty amazing gardens with things that, you know, most Westerners don't know what it is, things like sesame. You know, I had never seen a sesame plant in my life, and it's like every Chinese gardener had these huge sesame leaves everywhere, and, you know, so, so first we started asking for their participation in garden tours in the summer, and then during the seed swap, the garden committee, you know, was soliciting our international gardeners to save seeds and explain to others at the seed swap event, you know, what it was. And so it just, you know, the possibility suddenly of, you know, the kinds of activities you could do in the gardens. I don't know, they just kept expanding exponentially. So that when I took over after 2 years of being on the committee, you know, Bob Gifford was on his way out, and people, they didn't beg me, but, you know, they encouraged me strongly to be the garden chair. And I shy away from responsibility in a horrible way, but I couldn't say no. And in fact, I don't ever was formally the chairperson until the university one day called me. I guess I was the only person. You know, there's always an interim period when there's like no leader or no chairperson and nobody knows who to talk to. Mm-hmm. Somebody called me. It was, I think it was John Harrington. Do you know John Harrington?
I haven't met him personally, but I do know who he is.
Yeah, it was his landscape architect.
Yeah.
Or if it wasn't John Harrington, it was, I don't know, was it John Wiley? I don't know.
Okay.
Somebody else who said, oh, yeah, you know, we want to talk to the gardens. Oh, I mean, maybe it was Kathy Bruner.
Oh, okay.
I was always very, you know, very close with Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
You know Kathy Bruner?
Yeah, I really like Kathy.
She's wonderful.
She's wonderful, yep.
But there was just this one moment when somebody called and it's like, oh yeah, we need to talk to the gardeners, the campus natural areas, you know, wants to do something out there. And then when they said what it was, it was like, whoa, you know. It was basically, yeah, we want to annihilate, we want to get this piece and that piece of the gardens and plant it into prairie. And we're like, oh, that's a great idea, but. So I think that was the moment that kind of catapulted me into the garden leadership role for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when you got that phone call, what was your reaction? How did you think about going about not letting them take pieces of
My reaction right away was pretty strongly in the vein of this is not how we want to do things here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think what happened was since I was a conservation biology student,
mm-hmm.
that the folks over in landscape architecture, I'll put a name to it. John Harrington was, mm-hmm. I think, was the architect of the plan at that time of mm-hmm. what to do with the campus natural areas.
Uh-huh.
And so I think he made a mistaken assumption that, you know, whatever, because I am a prairie enthusiast, and I always was, and everybody knew that it was sort of national expansion
mm-hmm.
Was going to be planned, that I was going to be right behind it.
Yeah.
You know, except, you know, and so they saw the gardens, the natural areas, campus natural areas, and landscape architecture for its role in the campus natural areas. They presumed at that moment that the gardens was, you know, on board.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we were, because we're smack in the middle of it.
Yeah.
But the mistake was they weren't thinking collaboration mm-hmm. in the true sense of collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was doing my thesis on. I was doing my whole thesis on collaboration in stakeholder management of natural areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so I had the philosophy of how that should be done, how it's best done, and how it's most successful.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw it coming our way, mm-hmm. you know, this non-collaboration around some plan for the natural areas, I kind of hit back hard right away.
And
I said, oh, you want to call a meeting? And they went so far with saying what their plan was and, you know, what parts of the garden they thought should get plowed under and planted in prairie.
Uh-huh.
That I said, all right, well, you know, we'll have a meeting, but, you know, I'm gonna call some people there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what did I do? Of course, I went out to the gardens.
Mm.
And it was, you know, it was after classes, you know, early evening on a mm-hmm. on a late summer day. And, you know, if I didn't know who they were, they knew who I was, because I was always there, and people tend to know who the garden chair is.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started walking around and saying, hey, you know, in an hour, the university wants to call a meeting over in the Eagle Heights Community Center. And I got to be frank, they're talking about getting rid of your plot and your plot and your plot. You know? And so we got to that meeting. That first meeting,
mm-hmm.
and this was the mistake, you know, mm-hmm. this is for the first meeting, this isn't really how you want it to go. We got to that first meeting, and there was John Harrington and a couple of the campus planners,
mm-hmm.
and maybe Kathy Bruner as well, you know, so let's say four people from, you know, who were the architects of that plan,
mm-hmm.
and there must have been 60 or 70 gardeners.
Boom.
Wow. You know.
Yeah.
And these are not people who were listening every day to the conversations of, you know, the campus natural areas. These
uh-huh.
are people who had a garden plot for 10 years and lived over in Shorewood or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And, I think we had one of the, you know, and nobody knew who the gardeners, I mean, I knew who the gardeners were, but, the university never really thought about who was gardening there, and
uh-huh.
so we had a state representative with a garden plot that was, you know, in the area that was going to be, you know, planted with prairie, and, you know, so suddenly all these people were like, hey, you know,
yeah,
you know, and so that was kind of how it started. It started with you know, not a little bit of controversy,
mm-hmm.
and of course, a lot of people. Uninformed and feeling like they weren't being invited
mm-hmm.
to, you know, to plan
mm-hmm.
that. So now I get to ask you a couple questions, okay?
Okay, definitely. Go for it.
What has happened to the Biocorp Prairie and whatever other prairies they may call it out there. And has the garden shrunk, and has the prairie expanded?
Yeah, so the garden right now, there are no more of the finger plots.
No more,
right?
Okay.
Which is that's the main part that they were going to take away, is that correct?
There were some fingers, and then there was part of the contiguous square as well, but...
Yeah,
okay.
So that they, I believe, so the finger's gone, but they added a few more plots east of that to make the garden more square in that direction. But they also, I think they removed some of the 600s to put in the F.H. King Students for Sustainable Agriculture plots.
Oh, yeah, it almost went from that element. Yep.
Yep, so there's that stand of trees right in the middle and all of the 600s that were past that.
Are the trees still there? Or did they?
The trees are still there.
Oh, God. There's a bunch of invasive trees.
Yeah. There's still two stands of trees.
Okay.
So I think the gardens are slightly smaller than when you were there. But the prairie, I think they haven't succeeded in some of the places where they're still working hard on prairie. So where the finger plots were, there's not a prairie there yet.
Yeah.
I think they planted it from what I heard from Will Waller. Was he around?
Nope.
No, I think he came just after you. I think he's gardened there just about 10 years or a little less. But he said that they planted that for a year or two in soybeans, but they still haven't made it into a prairie, sort of a wild mass of invasives and maybe some prairie species.
Yeah.
So that field right to the north of the gardens. And then to the directly to the east of the gardens, there's, so at the top of the hill.
Oh, but yeah, top of the hill.
On top of the hill, there's one patch, I guess if it's northeast, that's pretty well established garden. So there's the very farthest corner of the gardens, if you can picture that.
Yep.
Diagonal from that is prairie, but directly south of that, still on top of the hill, near where the grounds, there's the berm, and then the grounds has all their dumping area.
All right. So, sounds virtually the same.
Yeah, but that part is, they're really struggling. They've been mowing that all year, trying to get rid of the weeds and stopping the weeds from seeding, and that's not even close to a prairie, but they're trying. I think they've plowed it up once or twice,
uh-huh.
And they aren't succeeding turning that into a prairie yet. So the prairie isn't very much of that area as of yet.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard area to make into prairie. So does that make sense? So the finger's gone, but they added a few plots west of that to make it more square. But then you have some 600s that are gone, and I think some 500s that are gone.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then the prairie is struggling along in various places. Yeah.
Yeah, as the prairie always will.
As the prairie always will, exactly.
Prairie restorations will always struggle.
Yep.
And that just has to be accepted.
Yep.
I think.
Yeah. But after that first meeting, you continued to have meetings? When did you...
Oh, my God.
Endless.
I don't know. I think we... the details are fuzzy.
And when was that first meeting? In 2000? 2001? Not even then.
Oh. 1999? Oh, boy. Let's say 99.
Yeah.
Let's say 99. Now there should be, hopefully there is some record of all of that through the newsletters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now we had a garden newsletter that we were distributing specifically to the gardeners because we didn't want to. We had a lot to say.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to. I haven't found. Maybe I just haven't dug enough. It's definitely not. I found a lot of the Eagle Heights newsletters that have some garden columns in them.
Yeah, those are garden columns. And then at that time,
there was actually
like
a garden newsletter
own,
too. I'm going to have to look for that.
Garden newsletter. Mm-hmm. You know, and boy, I know I wrote the newsletter, but I know I don't retain the files anymore.
Yeah.
But
well, I'll search.
Yeah, there's got to be some somewhere.
Yeah.
It's got to be. I would think Jan Sternbach would somewhere in those archives have something.
Mm-hmm.
But if she doesn't, you know, I don't. You might ask John Harrington.
Yeah, he might have them.
Okay. Yeah. Tell them all I say hello. No hard feelings.
Oh, 1 second, David.
Sure.
It's okay. Okay, you can go again.
Yeah. You know, he... Well, actually, I don't know that he does have that. He wasn't a gardener at the
mm-hmm.
time, but...
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. So, you know, what happened? What happened? Oh, we had... Basically, what our response to that moment where we had, you know, a university department, you know, asking for the land that was currently, at that time, gardens.
Yeah.
Our response was, my response was, this garden has as much educational value as that prairie does.
Mm-hmm.
The only problem is that, you know, we're not an academic entity.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so while there's lots of potential and there have been a lot of initiatives, there's never been, you know, there's not the consistency that, you know, people who have professors and paid staff have.
Yeah.
And so my push at that moment was, you know, let's make this place as much of a formal institution of the university as we possibly can.
Mm.
And so I started networking as hard as I could within the academic walls of the university to find the supporters who would, you know, not only speak up in support of the garden, but also figure out how to integrate the gardens more long term into some of the things that they were doing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that network was the most fascinating part, I think, of, you know, my graduate studies. A lot of my energy right there turned towards, I was meeting people left and right who I hadn't known were there.
Mm-hmm.
Guys like Rick Brooks.
Rick Brooks?
Rick Brooks. Who knows? He's one of these guys who sits in some academic department. He was the most inspirational guy who I could never figure out. He's somehow loosely connected to the Department of Genetics.
Hmm.
But what he was doing was he had an academic position. He was paid through the university, and basically he was working with old folks to do gardens for elderly people, you know, who could bend over and whatnot. He was one person. Krishna Ramanujan, who we mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
He was also Bill Cronin's student.
Oh, okay.
Did Bill ever mention that to you?
No, Bill hasn't. Bill doesn't always
remember
those,
going
but, yeah, no. No, I didn't know that he was Bill's student. I'll have to look him up.
I'm pretty sure he was one of Bill's students.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and it was probably then through Krishna that the university. I can remember the moment well where I think it was Kathy Bruner who, you know, Kathy never took sides. That's the thing I love about Kathy is. I think she realized really early on that, you know, the restoration plan that was coming from landscape architecture to John Harrington, that wasn't a good approach, at least from the people side of things. And so I can remember, you know, Kathy always kind of, she played very impartial. She was always very wise. She was working for John Harrington.
Mm.
And for Gary Brown in, you know, facilities planning.
Mm-hmm.
So she was sort of under them in a way, but she understood the people much better than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we would always, you know, end up in the gardens because she was out there working and I was out there working.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember her conversation. She's like, well, you know who just jumped on board on your side? Bill Cronin. So I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, oh, yeah, apparently Bill, you know, was at a meeting with John Harrington and, you know, he spoke up and everybody listened to Bill Cronin. And Bill's got quite a name for himself. So
yep.
I was like, oh, great. I knew nothing about it, but I could tell it. I could tell it, Krishna was, you know, somewhere underneath that.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a character. I hope you contact Krishna. He and his wife, oh, I can't remember his wife's name. Karen, right?
Karen.
They were great. They were very involved at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Krishna has a huge amount of charisma that he pushed around. You know, I think he pretty much walked right into the alumni foundation and said, "Hey guys, I'm one of Bill Cronin's students, and you know, don't try to stop me, but I'm going to do an article for you all about you high gardens. What do you think?" They're like, "Oh, yeah, okay, go ahead." You know, so he wrote that article of his own initiative.
Okay. Okay.
You know, at the time when you know all that was going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like I said, you know, my reaction and approach was to try to get things going in a way that were educational and that fit into the university's mission.
Mm.
You know, so I took the gardens through what I will call an organizational development phase, or yet another one, where I tried to turn it into a direction that, guys, we can't just hide on their land anymore.
Mm.
That you know, that era is over. We need a mission statement that that fits in with the university mission statement, you know, for being an educational place. So I don't know if that mission statement is even known, but we came up with it. We had it. You know, we met on it. We adopted it. We wrote it in a newsletter.
Huh.
I don't know if anybody ever knows it anymore, but
I'm not sure. I think they may have even written a new mission statement.
Oh, okay.
Unless
okay.
It's the same one.
What does that sound like? Can I ask?
It's on the website and it has maybe 4 points. You should check, I think it's on the bottom right-hand corner of the website. But if you have a copy of the mission statement you wrote, I would love to see it.
You know, the only thing, I will search through old documents. What I may have is a bunch of stuff stored on 5-inch floppy disks.
Hmm.
You know?
Yep, I do.
And I don't have anything that reads those anymore.
I know. I wonder if I could find something interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'll look. There's a couple. I have a computer I don't use much. Maybe somewhere archived remotely in there is a folder that says Eagle Heights Gardens.
Mm.
Because I was doing what you were doing, so I don't think I would have thrown everything away. But
no.
A long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was it. Okay. You know, tried to build networks. I went and, you know, what did I do? I tried to leave a structure there, which I heard it got built, and it is it was a big arbor made out of locust wood.
Yep, it's still there.
Does it get used?
Not a lot. They've planted heirloom grapes on the corners, but they've been very slow to grow. So it doesn't, right? Well, in the summertime, it doesn't have any shade because they want grapes over it or something to provide more of a shade.
That was the idea. Something up it. Well,
yeah. So nothing. It's not covered yet. So I think that stops it from being used a little bit. The garden meetings the last few months have been out at the arbor, and we're having one. This Tuesday or Wednesday will be a potluck out by under the arbor.
Oh,
there's a few picnic tables.
Somebody once mentioned, just on a side, that to look on the internet for a small silk parachute, you know, like the kind of...
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea.
Just drape that over the top of it.
Yeah, while we're waiting for the grapes to grow.
Exactly. But yeah, so, you know, I did that because you know, we were talking about, well, how do we make this an educational place? And we were saying, well, we give garden classes, and like I say, we started expanding that notion. Karen Ramanujan did a children's garden that was wildly popular. She only did it for one season before she had to leave. Mm. You know, and then everybody was asking for it again. Mm. You know, and she went around finding, you know, the curriculum for, you know, kids gardening, and you know, so suddenly we were a big network. We were networked with the National Garden Association, who was, you know, teaching us how to do children's gardening. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we tried to bring in the international gardeners, and so the idea was that under that arbor, during the summer, every couple of weeks or something, there would be a garden class offered at a regular time, where at the beginning of the season, here's what I was trying to do at the end there.
Yeah.
There was so much energy I was pouring into it, and it was all volunteer, that I started talking to the Alumni Association and others about, you know, can we think about somehow getting a garden position, and the Alumni Association was involved, because I was thinking, you know, can't we maintain a database of our gardeners so that we can try to fundraise an endowment for a garden coordinator position? And it was the idea of, you know, how much money would you have to raise to be able to pay a garden coordinator, you know, to do these kinds of things.
Yeah.
And that would be, you know, at the beginning of a season, lining up garden classes, you know, people who are reliable and will actually show up, who you can, you know, pay a little bit of money to give the class, do that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So with all those big ideas in mind, me having to leave, I was like, okay, at least what I can do is build something that will make people remember what those ideas were.
Huh.
So I commissioned the arbor to be built. And years after I had left, I heard that they had actually finished that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
When did you leave?
I graduated, I think my last season in the gardens was probably the summer of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I take it back. I left Wisconsin in 2003, and I maintained the garden plot. Yeah, all those years.
Okay.
You tell me, my garden plot was up in the 500, 600 row, and I planted, there's a story behind it, but a couple apple trees and maybe even a pear tree.
In the 500s and 600s?
Yeah.
I don't think there are any.
There's a mulberry tree up in the path, or at least there always
is. There is a mulberry tree up there, and I think...
And so I had all the plots right around that mulberry tree, and one of them...
Oh.
Oh, no more apples? Somebody cut it down?
Well,
dwarf apples in that plot.
Those are... The 500s and 600s are further, unless they were all renumbered, the 500s and 600s are further down the hill. I think the mulberry tree is in the...
Yeah, it's not the topmost. It wasn't the topmost row, but...
I think there actually... Yeah, I think there is at least one apple tree up there. Yeah. So you planted
that. Yeah, there were neat things going on. There was a student in the physics department who embarked on a project to plant his food... He was totally into math, and he always thought mathematically. He was going to plant his food in a radius around where he lived. He wrote himself. This is hilarious. He wrote up a grant proposal that he brought around to all these nurseries, and his grant proposal was to do just that: to plant a radius orchard around where he lived. So no matter where he was, without much hassle, he could. You know, he could harvest some food. And he got a grant. And so he came by and he said, hey, here's how it works. You get half, you know, if there are 10 apples hanging on the tree, you can take 5 of them, but you got to call me and let me know that there are 5 left for me. So, all right, man, you can plant a couple trees, you know, in my garden. So he did that.
That's great.
Yeah.
So he didn't have a plot. He just wanted to plant an orchard around where he lived.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't have a plot. He had many, many plots all around the city. And, yeah, I think he did that in all the community gardens and other spaces where, you know, he wanted, like, a line of different, you know, and I don't think it was just trees. I think there were, you know, there were all sorts of things. He probably had a, you know, small bit of food growing in, you know, every corner of Madison.
That's fantastic. What a great story. Oh, man.
So, yeah, a lot of characters in the garden.
Yeah, many characters. So you had all the plots up around that mulberry tree.
Yeah,
in, the
in my biggest moment, I had four plots, and I could never take care of them all. But I usually maintained two plots, one on either side of that mulberry tree.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It's a nice area up there. It's good.
And, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think I left that plot with asparagus in the ground and a couple apple trees. You know, and that's always been the one of the other things that I hope the gardeners will always, you know, fight to maintain, is that was the only perennial community garden that we knew of. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's the only one where you can plant perennials, and that's huge. Mm-hmm. You know, and so one of the when the land conflict came about with the university, one of their first solutions. I mean, this is why I say they were on the wrong track. Mm-hmm. Their first solutions was, well, you know, all these people who aren't students, they should not be here.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, and so right away, you know, we said, no, you can't just change the whole nature of this garden in one fell swoop by kicking out, you know, these are the people who have kept it running since the 1960s, you know, the people who graduated and kept their plots.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming those folks are still allowed to be there, and are there in force?
Yep, they are there in force. That's really who the garden committee is made up of primarily.
Yep. And so then you well know, I mean, those are the institutions, you know, that we had to really fight for and say, you know, this, you know, the idea that they wanted a prairie and in the same time they wanted some control over, you know, what our organization was going to be and look like. We were like, no, you know, you stay away from our organization and talk to us about the land, and we'll try to work that out.
Mm-hmm.
So, what else can I tell you?
Oh, I don't know.
Where are you going to try to go with? What do we call it?
Academic
jargon.
The thesis of my thesis. my research
statement.
What are my questions?
Yeah.
I
mean, I won't say what's your hypothesis, but
no, don't have one of those.
Well, that's right.
I'm really just fascinated, as you have very eloquently said, by this place and what makes the garden a place, both ecologically and through different communities. One thing that I've been thinking a lot about are the how boundaries are formed, both between different community groups or different groups of people that use the garden, as well as how boundaries are mediated, formed, moved, trespassed, between different plots, but also between the gardens and the rest of the preserve, which is something you talked about a little bit, just how land use decisions are made, how people talk about the boundaries that are formed, especially, I mean, what I'll mention right out is there, everybody talks about the weeds of the garden. That's a big problem right now, you know, but it's all perennial, you know, a perennial problem are the weeds, but a weed depends on where you are. What's a weed in the garden is not a weed in the prairie. It also depends on who you are. Like the the Asian gardeners, I see them out in the, you know, the weedy field that they're trying to be a prairie, I think, picking
right.
who knows what, you know, but they, or the purslane, which we always just pick on and throw away, which is a bad weed out there. So I guess I'm looking a bit at, you know, what makes the gardens a place and how different people view them, their history, but also how we talk about and go through boundary formation processes, both ecological and social. Well, it's a lot of land use things. Does that make sense? Land use, just sort of land use issues too. A lot of what you talk about.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I mean, would you agree that, I mean, there's always some geographic type of component that usually, well, not always, but usually that's, you know, the first thing that's creating the boundary, even out in a little place like the gardens, mm-hmm. you know, in the gardens it can be, well, it's a road, it's an mm-hmm. access road.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden that access road just defined, you know, it makes sense that the gardens will be on one side of it. You know, and uh-huh. there's a ridge, or in this case, there's going to be a soil delineation somewhere on that hill where mm-hmm. where the soil thins out or whatever, or it becomes rocky, mm-hmm. That the gardeners figure, oh, that's too much trouble now.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, who knows how it took that original shape?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's hard to tell, but it's been neat. Most of the interviews that I've done so far have been with people in the early 60s.
Ah, can I ask?
Yeah.
You talked to?
Yeah, who have I talked to? I have talked to a man named Jerry Cowley, who I think was there right at the beginning. I think where the gardens are now is actually their third location.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so they were where the further... So. Their first place, they were just there for a year, it sounds like. I haven't figured out exactly where that was, but it was some, I believe maybe where the 700s of Eagle Heights is now.
I think you're right, yeah.
Sort of north.
Yep.
And then they were there just 1 year, I think in 59. I'm not entirely sure of the dates. And then they moved, then that was going to be built on for more housing, and they moved to an old apple orchard.
Uh-huh.
It's like directly north of Hugh Houses.
That sounds familiar too.
Yeah. And I talked to, who did I talk to who gardened there? A man named Robert House, who's a doctor in Vermont, or a retired doctor in Vermont right now. And also somebody named Richard Lawton, who's a retired professor of chemistry in Michigan. So they were there, they were in this orchard area for maybe 6 years until those were also going to be built on. And then it was interesting, it was Robert House who told, he was the chairman when they were being moved, and he was talking about how they had to negotiate with the university to get new land for the gardens, and some people on the garden committee wanted to protest that the land was being taken to be developed, and he wanted to not have open protests, but go through the channels and talk to the Board of Regents. And so eventually they got the new land where it is today.
Yes.
From the College of Agriculture. You weren't paying rent on the land when you were a gardener, were you? Was the garden committee paying rent?
I went and I found those two in the Steenbach Library.
Yeah. Yeah.
At one point.
Mm-hmm.
Now I remember those.
Yeah, so they were paying... I don't know when the garden stopped paying rent to the College of Agriculture for that land, but it wasn't happening in the 90s, I assume.
No.
It wasn't. So, and I'm going to talk to somebody from the early 80s, I believe, who's also the chair, and his name is George Kerr. So, hopefully I haven't gone much into the 70s or 80s. History or how people viewed the garden.
Yeah, I think that was a really quiet period,
mm-hmm.
actually. Mm-hmm. After all the agreements, and I don't think memory, there wasn't a whole lot of meeting or discussion about it.
Yeah.
Running sort of the golden era of peace.
You know? Peace in the gardens. They're just there. Yeah, and it's when I mention what I'm doing my research on, people sort of say, oh, there's not just records about the garden? No, nobody paid attention to it.
Nobody made a drawer for it.
It was just there. It was just what part of the university needed to pay attention to it? Nobody did. So, yeah. One thing, maybe you have some suggestions. I'd really like to find ways of talking to the international, and especially maybe what they call now the Chinese grandparents. I don't know if they were around, the people who don't speak a lot of English, who I don't feel like, it's one of the multiple community questions that I have, is that this place is used by so many different people who come to it for different reasons. And one group of those are all of the Asian parents and grandparents who come and live with their graduate students for a while at Eagle Heights.
Yep.
You know, and I haven't found a good way of connecting to that community yet.
That's hard.
It is hard. Yeah.
You got to look for a liaison.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard. And do you have any Chinese graduate students in geography?
Yes, I should ask her to come out with me sometime.
Yeah. If you can find someone who speaks Mandarin, and hopefully that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who's a student in your department or
mm-hmm.
a friend of yours, and
mm-hmm.
see if you can get them involved for a little while for those interviews. Or, that would be great, right?
Yeah, it would be fantastic.
Hey, Emma, I'm sitting in my car now.
Yes,
I have to go pick up my daughter.
Yeah, it makes complete. You've been extremely helpful. So
it's been my pleasure. And if you need if you need a second conversation.
Oops.
Still there?
Yep, I'm still here.
Okay. If you need a second conversation, by all means, call me back.
Okay. And please, I usually ask at the end of these if you have any questions. Please feel free to email me with any questions you think of about the gardens or anything that you want to know. And
thank you. Yeah, I'm sure I'll think of something.
Yeah, email me, give me a call, whichever. It would be great.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Emma.
It's been great to talk to you too, David. Thanks so much.
All right, good luck to you.
Yep, bye.